Hello, all you likable Luna moths out there. Welcome to another episode of A Little Greener, a podcast all about nature, conservation, and sustainability. My name is Casey. I am one of your hosts, and I am joined by the very likable Sarah. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. That was a spectacular intro. Thank you, Casey. Well done. I just said our topic didn't lend itself very well to any particular animal, but you just lined it up and knocked it out of the park.
Challenge accepted. Also, this is the first time. Ooh, I see the sunset out the window.
Oh, lovely nature moment.
Yes. Oh, lost my train of thought. I was about to be so proud of myself for like getting back in the groove of things for podcasting. So that was about as smooth an intro that I could have asked for. And then just like went out my brain. How you doing this week, Sarah?
I'm doing all right. I'm a mixed bag. I've been a little bit under the weather the past few days. Nothing major, but just not a whole lot of energy, which is kind of a bummer.
Sarah, have we talked about your like big thing that you're working
well,
towards?
I was just about to say, but so we're recording every other week. So this like earlier weekend into last week was really good because we haven't said I'm training for a marathon. I'm running the Chicago Marathon in the fall and I'm very excited for it. It's a little bit too early to actually like officially be doing marathon training, but I don't run regularly, so I'm just trying to get in the habit of running regularly, and that has been going very well. And I did a 5-mile run last weekend and it was nice, and I've been doing most of my shorter runs just in my neighborhood. That has also been really nice. I think I've talked on the podcast before about how I only have mockingbirds in my neighborhood. And that is by and large the truth. It's mostly mockingbirds. But through going out on these little runs, I have spotted a few other types of birds in my neighborhood. And that's been really fun. And then I did my 5-mile run at a different neighborhood, like 10 minutes away. And there's some ponds and stuff. And I got to see so many fun nature things. I saw a glossy ibis. I saw a red-shouldered hawk that like flew right at me up into the tree, just all kinds of little fun nature-y things as I've been getting outside for this. So that was really good.
I think it's so cool that you can combine your passion for birding with your forays into running.
Yeah, it does slow down the pace a little bit. And I've seen this, I don't know if it was a bumper sticker or a car magnet that says, it says something like kind of driving, mostly birding, which made me laugh. And I sort of feel like I need to get a t-shirt that says kind of running, mostly birding on the back. So.
That's amazing. I'm 100% for that. For our listeners, Sarah has completed other marathons before, which I think is just incredibly impressive. And she's always like, well, it wasn't very fast, but like she, I think I'm sure you guys can attest to it too. I sure as heck have no capacity to be able to run a marathon. And so I'm always impressed by this. And I'm super excited for Sarah to be like you're training for this one. You're like,
I am. Yeah. That's the difference. I've never trained for one before.
She's run marathons, completed marathons. I know you object sometimes when I say you've run marathons. You completed marathons without training. It's wild, guys. So I'm so excited for you to be able to like, I don't know. That's such a cool goal and structure to add to, you know, something aspirational like running the Chicago Marathon. So that's super cool.
I'm excited to get nature time in for sure while we do it. So how about you?
Speaking of nature time, my wonderful friend Cassie gifted me a nature journal. It's a guided journal to nature.
I love that so much.
I know. It's called Thrive Where You're Planted, written by Andrea Dibbing. And I haven't started it in earnest. I've decided, because it goes month by month, that I'm going to like really dive in. It starts in March, but I'm going to dive in April and try and make it like part of my morning regimen, because my daughter now sleeps in enough that she's not the one always waking me up in the morning. I can sometimes get like 10 minutes to myself. Yeah, exactly. So it has some really wonderful like weather tracking, bird sort of observations, just writing down when you're in there, some musings on nature. So I'm excited to see all of the different things as the seasons progress. They've got like a little color wheel of, oh, what the weather is. Give a little color key and color it in. And I haven't colored in a long time, so I'm really excited about it.
That's so cool. And y'all,
Yeah.
Casey held it up for me. It's so pretty. I
It's
love
super
it.
cute.
I can't wait to hear about how it goes.
Yeah, we'll have to see. Maybe I can get a link to an independent bookstore that you could buy this, and if you guys can follow along too. It's Thrive Where You're Planted. So I'm very excited about this. It sounds like both of us actually have like maybe real scheduled outdoor time.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's happened in a while. That's exciting.
It is. It's very exciting. It makes me very happy. Also, you mentioning talking about observations with the seasons, which is a thing that we've talked about on the podcast before, and I believe was one of your challenges at one point, was something to pay attention for the changing in seasons. And I did just in the past couple of weeks see, this is one of my favorite times down here, where we see swallow-tailed kites around again. Really, I get, once again, I just get excited about them because they're very easy to identify. And I think they're really cool looking birds. So I love when I start to see them again. So that's been another fun nature observation that I've had here.
Wonderful. Our outstanding challenge of spending time in nature sounds like it's going to be more and more completed. We almost never
Yes.
do our
I
homework on time.
know. Hey, but we
Speaking of,
did.
we did. We
Yeah.
both did.
We did our homework from our last episode, which, again, y'all don't have to listen to these in order, but we do give a challenge every episode and try to just check in with each other on it, usually in the next episode. So last time we talked about the North Atlantic right whale, and you gave some challenges, Casey. Our challenge that we kind of gave to ourselves was to look more into the idea of a certification and to see whether that was something that was an idea that had been had or something that was in progress at all in terms of sustainability for lobster, particularly here in the United States and Canada, talking obviously specifically with the North Atlantic right whale, that being their habitat. So you and I both looked into this a little bit. Do you want to explain sort of what we did separately
Yeah,
and what we found?
totally. You have a little additional piece, but our go-to for sustainability in seafood is seafoodwatch.org. Highly recommend. They have so many amazing resources, and basically, they rate seafood options based on where they're from, like what area is in the populations, the method of fishing, and like the sustainability around it. And so we looked up American lobster because there are different types of lobster. I don't know that I even really like I should have thought about that, but I didn't. And they have ranked different populations, like things from southern New England to Maine to parts of Canada. And the summary that they have here is that you should avoid American lobster that are caught in the US and Canada, and that some American lobster fisheries may be certified by the Marine Stewardship Council. And oftentimes the recommendations sort of line up between Seafood Watch and Marine Stewardship Council. However, the fact that they disagree is pretty telling that Seafood Watch has additional issues. And when you dive into the recommendations, they specifically cite the entanglement of North Atlantic right whales in lobster pots in these populations. So there currently is no, according to Seafood Watch, sustainable option. Now, in addition, they'll list some of these populations are not well documented of the lobsters. Some of these populations may be threatened by disease, but the sustainability of the populations themselves are not the key issue. It's the whales. So there are other options. You could buy California spiny lobster that's caught in California or in Florida or in Mexico, and then Norway lobster caught in the UK, specifically using traps or at France with bottom trawls. And that's their recommendations versus our American lobsters.
Yeah, I thought that it was really nice how they laid that out, just sort of specifically American lobster caught anywhere in this vicinity. No. And you can look at the scores and like how they sort of ranked that. And it really is specifically coming down to, they take a little bit of a hit on sustainability for the environment as a whole, but it's really specifically due to their impact on other species of the whales. So yeah, that was really interesting. And the challenge with Seafood Watch, which we've talked about before, is you can't just go to a store or a restaurant and say, like, I want California spiny lobster because that's the sustainable choice, because it does depend on where it's caught and how it's caught
Right.
too. So if you are interested, if you are somebody who eats lobster, you do want to take a little closer look at that list, and you may have to ask some questions or do some searching on the packaging to find your sustainable option there.
And Sarah, you noted that you did find a conversation around whale-safe
Yeah,
lobsters.
I didn't do a whole lot of further digging, but I did come across, this is the website is just Maine Public. Maine, like the state, MAINE, mainepublic.org. And there's an article from back in 2019, the headline being Maine Lobstermen Skeptical of Proposal to Tie Whale Safe Seafood Label to Use of New Fishing Gear. And the article does go through a lot of what we talked about in the last episode in terms of our discussion of people maybe being interested in paying more for a sustainable product, conservation organizations arguing that yes, that's the case. We have the data to show that that is the case in other instances, versus the lobster industry sort of just saying, oh, we don't think this is necessary. We don't necessarily think that it's unsafe now, basically, it being sort of the pushback there. So it certainly is an idea that has been floated, but doesn't seem to have taken hold yet.
It's interesting. I'm definitely curious to see kind of what the future holds for like innovations in that industry, but we've talked about some of them last time. I had fun with last episode. Listen to it if you haven't.
Yeah, I think it's sort of inevitable,
Yeah.
personally. I think the change will come, and hopefully it will come soon enough for the North Atlantic right whale. So this week, Casey, we are changing gears completely from the seas to the skies. You gave us a wonderful clue with our Luna Moth introduction, but we are going to be talking about the moon in terms of the upcoming eclipse, which by the time you're listening to this episode, if you're listening in North America, this is probably days, if you're listening to it on our release day, before a part of North America experiences a total solar eclipse. So this was actually suggested by our friend Kristen, who is a friend to the pod and co-hosted a bunch of episodes last summer. So thanks, Kristen. This was a really fun suggestion. And Casey, didn't get too creative with our question to start us off. We're going to be talking about the eclipse and animal behavior during eclipses and what we know about it. So, have you ever been in a total eclipse? Is this something that you've experienced before? What is your experience with eclipses?
I'm glad that you reminded me of what we had in 2017. It was a
Yeah,
mostly eclipse. It was like a partial eclipse,
we had a partial eclipse.
but it was a pretty significant one if I remember correctly. But I lived in an apartment complex. I think Andrew and I had just kind of started dating, and I remember myself and other people from the apartment complex walking outside and everything sort of changing, if I remember correctly, to kind of like an eerie red around you. Like it got dark, but it got like a little bit redder. And that could be my memory playing tricks on me. Sarah's looking doubtful. She's thinking
I don't remember.
awful.
My recollection of the 2017 one was that it was not that significant. Now I'll have to look up like what percentage of eclipse coverage that we got where we were in 2017. I feel like I remember being rather underwhelmed by it, but I also might be conflating it with last year. We had an annular eclipse. Where so
I don't even remember that one.
the sun was not totally blacked out. I just remember going outside and you could like stand with a colander or something like that facing away and
Okay.
hold it up and you would see like the crescent shaped shadows instead of the holes, which I still don't quite fully understand how that works. But yeah, I've never experienced totality that I can remember. So I'm a little sad because after doing reading and researching this episode, I'm sad that I'm not going to see it because two previous cities that I've lived in, I said that wrong. You know what I mean? Two cities that I've lived in previously are in the path of totality. And I did not make any plans to travel for this thing. And initially I was just kind of like, oh, well, whatever, you know, it's not that big a deal. And now I'm like, dang, I'm really sad I'm going to miss this.
The last one, I remember all the kind of the charts coming out being like, the next one is the big one. It's in 2024. I was like, great. Because it wasn't like, I was sort of still expecting to potentially live in that city. And yeah, now I'm outside of the range, I believe.
Yep.
But I'm still excited. I like it. It got like kind of dark. It got like the sun got kind of red.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's what I remember.
Well, we are going to talk a little bit about eclipses, what we see in the natural world in relation to eclipses, what we know about how animals act and respond. And I think it'll be a pretty fun time. So stick around for our discussion on animal behavior in eclipses. All right, thanks for joining us for another week of A Little Greener, folks. We are talking all about the upcoming solar eclipse if you are in North America. So on April 8th, 2024, North America is going to experience a total solar eclipse, meaning that the moon is going to pass between the Earth and the sun. So there's going to be a pathway across the continent that is going to experience totality. The moon is going to completely block out the sun. For those that are lucky enough to be in that path, the total eclipse is going to last for approximately like 2 to 4.5 ish minutes or so, that period of totality, with the eclipse period in general lasting from around 2 to 2.5 hours. The next total eclipse that's going to be visible from here in the contiguous United States is not going to be for another 20 years. So enjoy it, folks, if you are lucky enough to experience it. We'll talk a little bit more about how often these things happen in just a moment. So, Casey, you talked a little bit about what you remember from the eclipse.
Honestly, I might be remembering the air pollution that was around last year for the red part. Like, the more I thought about it, I'm like, maybe I'm thinking of what an eclipse kind of looks like from there, but then it didn't turn red, it just got dark.
Awesome. I don't know.
We were never...
I don't know.
Yeah, we were off for that terrible air pollution because I was literally giving birth, so...
Man.
But anyway, let's move into eclipse territory because that's way more fun than wildfire stuff.
Yeah, that is more fun than air pollution for sure. And I don't want to go too deep into the science of an eclipse or anything like that. But NASA has a ton of info. So if this is something that you're interested in, definitely explore NASA's website on eclipses. They've got so much info. It is really cool. So they have the stages of the eclipse. And so obviously it starts with just that partial eclipse as the moon starts to pass between the Earth and the sun before it's completely blocking it out, right? So you're going to just have that crescent-shaped sun that we've all seen pictures of. And then you get something called shadow bands, which is exactly what it sounds like, just bands of shadow and light that you can see apparently moving across the sides of buildings on the ground. And then really the entire reason that I'm mentioning this at all is because of this next thing called Bailey's beads. And cool. The way that they describe it is basically just as the moon gets farther across the surface of the sun, you get these points of light that come from the light rays passing through the different shapes, like the cavities, the crescents, the peaks on the moon's surface. And you just get like these different flashes of light. And I don't know why, Casey, but that just made me giddy almost when I read it. Like, how cool is that? That we can see differences in the sun's light shining through the topography of the moon. I don't know why that makes me so happy, but it really does.
I am looking up eclipse glasses.
Yes, please don't look at this, folks. Safety first.
That's why you cannot I was look reading at any outline, of these things. And it was like, don't look at it. And I was like, but I really want to.
Not look at it. Google some pictures. You can find, that's what I thought you were doing. You can look up some pictures of it. Do not look directly at the sun during any of these stages. I just feel like it gave, you know, the moon is obviously a far away, distant thing that just looks like a circle up in the sky. And it's just a nice reminder that it is there and it has its own distinct surface. And it's just really cool that we can see the effect of that.
You know, I love the moon. Yeah. We did a episode about the moon and its impact on wildlife, and I'm very excited anytime that the moon comes up into conversation. So yeah, it'll be super cool to take pictures of through a filter
lens. Yeah, when you can do so
this
safely.
Phenomenon. So okay, so can I watch this one through eclipse glasses?
Yeah, I believe so. If you have the
okay,
I mean that's what they're for, I think. Guys, don't take that advice from me. Search before
we're
you
not,
look at it. I didn't look at anything about eclipse glasses because I'm not going to see it. What I will say is when we do get to totality, there's another stage that NASA talks about. It's the diamond ring stage after Biela's beads are ending. And you see basically this sort of one mega bright spot before the moon completely blocks out the sun. But when you get to totality, I actually didn't notice this, but when you get to totality and the moon is completely blocking out the face of the sun, you can look at that without glasses. And I guess maybe that seems silly to not know that, because that's the whole point, is that the moon is blocking out the sun. But I just figured that people would be like, yes, it's still too dangerous, it's still too risky, don't do it. But they literally say you can view this with the naked eye. I'm like, no thank you, I will keep my glasses on.
No risk.
Please, because how I mean, I guess they have it like timed down to the minute, but also like, what if my watch is off by 10 seconds? Like, I am not messing with that.
You've got some,
my eclipse glasses.
4 minutes is like a lot.
Is it?
Yeah.
My eclipse glasses would be on the whole time. I am not taking them off, but.
I just purchased 20 eclipse glasses
no,
for my workplace.
Didn't.
Yes, I did. It wasn't that expensive. So I was like, we're going to be outside all day, so I might as well get them for everyone. I just looked it up also to see where I was at, and we're in around 90% totality. So that's
wow.
Cool.
Okay. That's closer than I realized. I guess I didn't go out as far as you were.
Western Pennsylvania, they get the whole deal.
Yeah. Nice. So that's it. That's the stages of the eclipse. Some other fun facts: during a total solar eclipse, the temperature may drop up to 10 degrees Fahrenheit, which is perhaps relevant to animal behavior during the eclipse. Also, during a total eclipse, you can see the sun's corona, which is like the outer layer of the atmosphere. So that's, again, why it freaks me out that they say you can look at it, because you are supposedly seeing this like glow around the
apparently that's not the problem.
The moon. And that is one of the things that scientists will study. That's one of the things that they will look at when we have the opportunity with a total eclipse. Part of what they're doing is learning more about that corona, that outer layer of the sun's atmosphere. As far as frequency of eclipses and how often you might get a chance to see, I also didn't realize this. There are anywhere from 2 to 5 solar eclipses that occur every year. Like, there has to be at least 2 a year, and there could be as many as 5 in a year, although that would be very rare. So all of this just has to do with the orbits of the moon around the Earth and the Earth around the sun and how things line up and just what the angle of the moon is in relation. So that's not total solar eclipses. That's just solar eclipses in general, whether it's the total or the annular. And the annular solar eclipse just happens when the moon is a little further away from the Earth in its orbit
Right.
when they line up, because then it's not, it doesn't appear large enough to us anymore to block out the total sun. So you're seeing that ring of sun around the outside. So 2 to 5 per year, a total eclipse happens about every 18 months, which is, again, more frequent than I would have thought. But the reason that it feels so rare to us is that in any given spot on Earth, a total eclipse happens only on average once every 375 years, which is interesting. And apparently changes whether you're in the northern hemisphere versus the southern hemisphere a little bit too. Like, I think you're a little more likely in the northern than in the southern, but still. So they can be tough things to see, and that's why people get so excited and are traveling to the path of totality. So, Casey, my question for you, as we kind of get into the impact on animals during an eclipse and the response of animals during an eclipse, why does this matter, do you think? Like, why should we even care? Why should we be interested about what animals do in an eclipse? Or should we? Do you think it matters?
Well, I think it matters, but I think a lot of things
Yeah.
that maybe the average American doesn't really like think is maybe particularly interesting or substantial when it comes to like animal behavior. But there's so many things we don't know about how animals perceive the world, and what influences them. This is like a very weird little micro moment that we can see what their reactions are. That being said, in the grand scheme of things we don't know, perhaps knowing what they do during an eclipse is not like the most pressing information, but it's fun that we get to do it.
Yeah. That feels very along the lines of what I came up with, because as I was starting to write this stuff down and to think about it, I did have a moment of like, well, I don't know that we really care. Because at first I was thinking about things like, you know, animals sense the world differently than we do. We think about things like maybe an animal's response to an earthquake, like where, and I have not looked into this at all, but certainly anecdotally, right, there are reports of animals sensing things like earthquakes before they happen and things like that. We know, I mean, I just think about like service dogs, like dogs being able to tell you that your glucose level is low by your smell, you know? So I think there's a lot to learn about how other animals are able to say, I mean, even just thinking about fish and some of the adaptations that they have, like pressure receptors and that sort of thing. I think there's a lot to learn about how animals sense and interact with the natural world. But an eclipse isn't really like that. You know what I mean? Like, there's nothing special happening. It just has to do with the alignment of these things moving around in space, right? There's nothing actually different in the day,
yeah,
when an eclipse happens. It just has to do with alignment. So I did have a moment where I was like, I don't know, maybe this doesn't matter. But
I think I hope they're not spending a whole lot of money,
right,
on it. I guess it's like the first thing, if these dollars could go somewhere else, then maybe it's worth that. I think it's really cool for like a citizen science element.
Yes.
I do wonder, like, what kind of sample size are you getting? Like, through this instance, it's like, we know during the one eclipse, under these specific conditions for the rest of the weather and all that kind of stuff, that this small subset of animals in this area did this.
Yeah.
And like, I would be more interested in like comparing that in context with a bunch of other like studies about, like, when there was all that air pollution in this area in June of last year, the sky was orange and the sun was red. It looked different. When we have this eclipse, it will be look different. The temperature, the atmosphere will all feel different. Like, what are we seeing similar behaviors during different types of phenomena like this?
Yeah.
All questions. Maybe not the most important questions, but exciting.
Yeah, and I think that all of that is part of it, because where I landed is that I do think that it matters, and it is more than just learning about what animals do during an eclipse. Like, yes, that is the immediate thing that we're studying. We are interested in seeing what the response of animals is to this event. But through that, we are really just learning more about animal behavior in general. We are learning about how they sense things and how they perceive things and what specifically their cues might be for different behaviors. So that's really interesting. This time around, one of the things that I came across, given the time of year that this eclipse is occurring, is that scientists are looking at the impact on migrating birds, many of whom fly at night. And that is one of the things, as we'll talk about, that we've seen from animal behaviors during eclipses, is that they sort of perform their nighttime behaviors. So are these migrating birds going to think, it's time, let's go, you know? I also saw some comments from researchers talking about how things that we pick up from studying animals in these eclipses might help us impact things like the impacts of light pollution and how we can respond and handle to that better. So I think there are actually big, helpful, beneficial animal behavior questions that we can look at during this eclipse and use animal behavior during an eclipse as just another piece of information for some of these bigger questions. And then, as you were saying too, it is also just fun. We know that there's nothing different happening during an eclipse, but animals don't know that. So I think it's kind of interesting to think about what might be going on in their brains as this is happening. So it's just kind of an interesting thing for us to think about. And it is a really great way to get a lot of people involved in something, which we will talk about how you can get involved with this if you are in the path of the eclipse at all or in a future one too.
I think that there's also personally just a value in those sort of moments that remind us that we all live on this planet together. And obviously this eclipse doesn't impact everyone on the planet, but it does impact basically all life forms in its path. And it's outside of all sort of social, political, class, like none of that really plays a role in what the heck is happening in the sky at that moment. And so I think it's a very cool moment that kind of can connect us to us experiencing it across humanity, different subsects, but also like, how do the rest of the animals do it in a way that's like not a disaster.
Yes.
Like so many of the other ways that you can classify that are like when a volcano erupts, and it's like, no. This is something that's just like kind of cool for a couple minutes and it doesn't have necessarily long-lasting impacts, but still sort of connects every living thing in that band of our planet.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It is just a fun, exciting thing. And yeah, I think that can help bring us together. So what do we know about how animals react to eclipses? It can be a tough thing to study. There certainly have been some studies done on it, but because of the infrequency of the eclipse or the fact that they're happening just in different parts of the world, it can be a tough thing to sort of put all together and quantify, which is why these community science projects are so important for studying things like this. There have been studies that do show significant behavior changes for animals. There are other studies that don't, or do show it for some species and don't show it for other species. So there's a lot still to learn about whether or not the response is significant. In what populations is it significant? Do all groups of the same species, do all individuals within a species respond to this in the same way? How close to totality do you have to be? Is what you're going to experience in 90% eclipse, is that going to be enough to cause any observable behavior changes or not? So this can be a challenging thing to study just because of the nature of what it is. We'll talk about what some of the studies have shown. But before we do that, I just want to talk through a little bit. And in some of these studies, too, you'll see it divided into, we think about, or I guess I should say they're interested in looking at both domestic animals. We look at wild animals in human care, like zoos and things like that, and then animals in the wild as well. So for domestic animals, Casey, I'm curious, you've got pets at home. How do you think that your pets would respond to a total eclipse?
I don't think that they're going to respond to a total eclipse. They're so dependent on artificial light. Like, no matter if they're the reptiles, the bird, the cat, the dog, if I keep the curtains closed during the day, they're getting variable amounts of light. So I feel like a couple hours of a change isn't really going to impact their lives. I even think if it was like the middle of summer and the tortoises were outdoors for like the entire day and we're on a normal light cycle, I still don't think they really care. If it got cold, then they might go inside. Like, they might go seek cover if they were out on a basking rock. That's, I think, maybe the only way that we would really see the impact in at my house.
And certainly the light change and the temperature change are the two big cues here. And I agree. I feel like the temperature change might be the only thing. But yeah, I to me, especially if you're not in the path of totality, I think there would be no response for all of the reasons that you just said. I mean, the idea is that an eclipse might disrupt like the circadian rhythms, like the natural cadence of an animal's day. And there just isn't, you know, my cat gets up with me at 4 o'clock in the morning when it's still dark. And there just is no sort of normal. So I think a change like that wouldn't matter as much. Domestic animals aren't necessarily going by that regular circadian rhythm. They're
That being said, like horses, would they, because they're outside all the time, like, would they have a different
Potentially, and
reaction, like
there
livestock?
have been some studies looking at horses, I think both domestic and feral horses too. So yeah, I'm sure it depends on how what kind of environment, you know, is a stabled horse is going to have less of a response to a horse that's out on pasture all the time. But I think, yeah, so basically the idea is that these domestic animals are just so much more dependent on us for their cues and not just the environment. So you're not likely to see as much of a response there. But in human care, so for animals that are not necessarily domesticated, but still cared for by humans, there definitely have been some observed behavioral changes. So I was reading one article that talked about decreased foraging from honeybees observed during the eclipse in 2017. And then a lot of the info that I found was coming from a study done during the 2017 eclipse from researchers at North Carolina State University, and they did observations at the Riverbank Zoo in South Carolina and observed a number of different species and their behavior changes. Their study, which we'll have linked to in the show notes, is called Total Eclipse of the Zoo, which I thought was
Excellent.
fantastic. Total Eclipse of the Zoo, animal behavior during a total solar eclipse. So they cited a number of different things. They saw behavior changes in animals anywhere from Galapagos tortoises, which was a really interesting one, actually. And they categorized this as just like an anomalous behavior. They
Probably.
started mating, and they
Yeah.
don't know why that was a behavior that they were not expecting to see. Giraffes running around, which has been observed both in the zoo and in the wild. They categorized this as more of like an anxious or a fear response. They heard some unique songs being sung by the Siamangs, a type of gibbon, and the noises that they make is referred to as singing. So different families will kind of have their own unique songs that they sing. And so they heard some different songs from the Siamangs than what they would normally see. Flamingos taking shelter and the rainbow lorikeets sort of doing their entire evening and morning routine. And that's just a handful. They mentioned some other things in this study, but that's kind of a good selection because you do have a few things like we talked about, animals sort of acting like, oh, it's getting dark, it's nighttime, or potentially, oh, it's getting dark, a storm is coming, for something like the flamingos taking shelter. The Galapagos tortoises just made me laugh. We don't know why that happened. And the giraffes I don't know. I guess a fear response, but it's funny to me. So that, like, that's a funny one to me. Giraffes are, from the people that I know that have worked with giraffes, they seem to be very skittish and very routine oriented. Yes. And anything that's out of place from their routine will throw them off. But it does seem funny to me that they would respond this way, because, like, it does. If I were an animal, I feel like if the sky gets dark, I am either treating it as it's bedtime or it's a storm.
Right.
And so
right.
I don't understand the response of
categorizing it as a fear response when the other animals seem to take it as it's getting nighttime, like the lorikeets, for example, in this, implies that the giraffes understand that this is not the right time for it to be getting dark, and it's a problem.
Yeah, which is
so
interesting.
or although question I guess you said that they saw this out in the wild too, because I do wonder for, like, a giraffe who lives at a zoo, and a lot of times they're, like, brought inside for the night if it was getting dark, if they were like, why am I outside still while it's dark, like, maybe that's what it was, is like more of a location confusion based on time. But yeah, wow. Well, guess what? My husband will have access to see some of these animals during this time period, not during a total eclipse.
Yeah.
Because we're in
but
the partial
but
zone.
that's
But
important too. We want to know how dark does it have to get? How significant does the change have to be? What are they
I'm giving him
perceiving?
homework.
Excellent. Sorry, Andrew. I know. If I know him, he will be also interested. So,
I have enough eclipse glasses for him, so it's fine.
Oh gosh! Just remember to research the safety before you use your eclipse glasses. Don't look at the sun based on my recommendation. So, in the wild, we do have some observations of animals in the wild too. There was some data from 2017 again showing that animals like bald eagles and wild horses changing the speed and direction of their travel, likely as if a storm was approaching. Makes sense to me. Seems like a reasonable response. I was reading an article from National Geographic, which will be in the show notes, that had some anecdotes from a few other eclipses around the globe. So there was one eclipse chaser, as he is described, in Hungary in 1999 for a total eclipse. And he recalled seeing various species of birds and bats suddenly appear. So he's speculating, you know, the light intensity, was that the cause? Was it the fact that other bugs came out that brought them out? But he felt like that there was increased activity from those animals. There was another eclipse chaser. I'm, like, avoiding these names because I don't know how to pronounce any of them, but the article will be linked for you if you're interested. In Hawaii for a 1991 total eclipse. And he also noted increased activity among birds. He had a quote that it was so loud that we could hardly hear each other talk. And then once totality actually came, it was perfectly quiet. So the quote is, we could hardly hear each other talk. Then came totality, not a sound. It was deathly quiet. The difference between the noise levels before and during totality was stunning. And then another story from Zambia in 2001. This person noticed that as the sun disappeared, there was noise from frogs. Raptors stopped flying. And then there's the other one. This is where we saw giraffes running about during the whole totality. And she says, when the sun came back, the giraffes stopped and began grazing the trees again. So that is something that's been observed in both places, at least anecdotally.
You mentioned the phrase bats suddenly appear, and I just thought of that song, why do birds
suddenly appear?
But it's not, why do bats suddenly appear?
Well, it's perhaps either the bugs or
the bugs or the darkness,
who knows.
The question will be answered.
But the total eclipse of the zoo study, I didn't comb through the whole thing, but just skimming over it, it had some other just interesting things that they noticed at the zoo, their observations there, and it does have links to some other studies as well if you're interested in that. Again, they do sort of categorize it into these four areas, which seems to cover pretty much your basis of how an animal could respond. Either they're going to do their nighttime behaviors, they're going to be anxious about something. They might show just some random behavior like mating, or not show a response at all. Those were sort of the four categories that they used for their study. So that's kind of what's been done. That's certainly not the only study, but that type of thing is what has been done. It's just a lot of observational and then compiling data and looking at this information from different parts of the world and kind of putting it together and seeing what sort of similarities that you can see. So, how can you help with this? If you are in the path of the eclipse, Casey, this is you, because this is whether it is full or partial, you can help participate in North Carolina State University Solar Eclipse Safari Project and record your observation. So, again, this is the same university that was doing that study from 2017. So they are continuing to gather more data. And again, I'll have the link to this in the show notes. You can see it down in the list in the bottom, Casey, if you're interested. But they have a little more info there on what you can do and how to submit your own observations and all of that. And then the other study that I found that I thought was really cool that you can participate in, hopefully in the future, even if you are not in the path of the eclipse, is NASA's Eclipse Soundscapes study. And this is kind of cool. They're really kind of building on this idea of your observations being multi-sensory. So they are having people record sounds, obviously. So they have this, you would have had to be a recorder. You would have had to participate a lot sooner than this. So the ship has sailed on this part, but they've got people collecting audio data and also making observations about what they see or feel or hear during the eclipse. That part I think you can still do. Again, if you are listening in the days before the eclipse, I think you can't be a recorder, but I think you can be an observer still. And so you can get on NASA's Eclipse Soundscapes study website and look for information on that. But the cool thing is, there should be a data analyst role that's going to be available later in the year, hopefully. They don't have too much information on that yet, but man, if we get to help sort of like go through and sort the information that people have submitted, I'm all about that. That sounds fantastic. And you can do that from wherever you are. So I would just say keep an eye on that. And if you want to be a data analyst for NASA for their eclipse study.
Put that on your
Right.
resume. Very cool. I was just thinking about, doing all these observations on animals. If an alien was watching Earth and
Doing
was like,
observations on
"What do
us.
humans do during a solar eclipse?" Oh, well, many of them exit their burrows at that time and don special face wear. They look up at the sky and they become quiet too, just sort of quietly talking to each other. And then when it's over, they all go back to their burrows.
Yep. I wonder how they would interpret that data.
It's a great question. Well, one day, have to ask them.
Well, on that
Yeah.
note, that's what I've got for you. Basically, there's just a lot of observations. Animals do some interesting things, and I think it's fun. I think it's fun to note how different species respond and let the researchers extrapolate from there.
Yeah. Go, you know what? This is just one of those other times to go outside. Just go outside. Don't look directly into the sun, but go outside.
feel like we're going to need to put a disclaimer on. Please do not look directly at the sun. Yeah, we'll get to our challenges. You're jumping the gun on me, but yes,
okay,
no,
okay.
Stick around, everybody, and we will be right back with a wrap up and your challenges for this episode, which you can probably already guess. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. We hope you enjoyed this fun little foray into what animals do during a solar eclipse. Your challenges for this episode are not a surprise. If you are listening to us from here in North America and you are in the path of this eclipse at all, your challenge is to participate in one of those community science projects, whether you want to do the solar eclipse safari or the NASA soundscapes project, or look up locally because your local zoo, nature park, some other organization might also have a project that they are doing. Previous years, there have been things on iNaturalist. I couldn't find any when I searched a couple of days ago, but worth a search on platforms like that as well. Again, if you are in this path somewhere, just see if there is a community science project you can get involved in. It does help, even if we don't think this is the most pressing question that we could be asking. There are still cool things that we can observe and learn from this, and it just helps increase our connection to nature a little bit. If you are not like me and you're not in the path of this at all, your challenge is still to get out there and observe. So you hit the nail on the head, Casey. Just go outside. Again, we talked about for those in the path of totality, it's going to be 2 to 4 minutes or whatever it was that I said. So just go outside for a couple minutes and use all of your senses and like really observe rather than just getting your nature time in. Go outside and just find something, find a bird. Watch it for a few minutes, really think about what it's doing and why it's doing it, what its cues are, and all of that, and just kind of try to engage your senses in some kind of animal observation, even if it's not during an eclipse.
Thank you so much for this episode, Sarah. I honestly have been out of the loop when it comes to the eclipse. My workplace is getting solar panels next week, and so I was like, guys, solar starts next week, and they were like, no, the solar, that's April 8th, and I was like, what are you talking about? They're like, the eclipse. And I was like, oh, they're like, what are you talking about? So I've been so far out of this loop that I am very glad. I feel very well informed now. And I'm excited for it. And now I have eclipse glasses coming in the mail.
Amazing.
Sarah, if people want to report their data to us and give us their anecdotal experiences, how can they do that?
They can find us on Facebook. We are A Little Greener Podcast. We're still in Instagram jail, but you can also send us an email at alittlegreenerpodcast@gmail.com. We're always happy to hear from you, whether it is your eclipse experience, questions, comments, suggestions for future episodes. We really appreciate your thoughts and feedback, and we really appreciate you listening.
And we will talk to you in 2 weeks.
Bye.